Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig, and I think we're dealing with a whole variety of issues surrounding vino. Is that correct?
Rather well, this is definitely a vino program.
Okay.
It's a wine program, but it's also a vino program because our first guest has developed a whole new way of understanding how people react to wine and how they can choose the wines that they'll find most interesting and most satisfying.
You know, I called it vinotyping. He says it's vino. And I called it vinotyping.
He says it's
vinotyping. Right.
Okay. And then we're going to talk to people about specific wines themselves. We're going to start with the Old World, with a country which has an extraordinarily unique wine culture. And then we're going to fast forward west across the big pond, across the United States to California, to talk about a very modern young man making wine. So that's the plan for today. So
without
further ado,
big ponds, are we?
Well, and if we were in Portugal and we were coming back to California, then we would definitely be crossing a big pond and crossing a large continent as well. So
great.
Mrs. Haig's geography needs a little work. Anyway, without further ado, vino typing. It's not fair of Tim Hennai to have a last name that's so difficult to pronounce. It's only five letters, for heaven's sake.
But we screwed it up a long time ago, somewhere on the transition from Switzerland or Finland to the U.S.
All right, so you're European, but by European, in fact.
Yeah, that's right. So somewhere it was Hani, but we made it Hennai.
Hennai, okay.
Well, you are a master of wine, and Peter will do most of the questions on this, but I do want you to know that I was elated to read your book because so much common sense comes through and you debunk so many of these very annoying wine myths. But let's move on. Peter has more questions. Oh, he's sitting poised for his first question.
I was just wondering where you were going with your little mini rant there. Turns out that Tim is a very brave man. He's a very knowledgeable man. We'll come back to that in just a second, and you'll understand why Tim feels qualified to overturn most of the thinking of the wine establishment. The wine establishment consisting of sophisticated winemakers and sophisticated wine drinkers and all lots and lots of other hangers-on who don't have a mind of their own. How about that, Tim? Is that right?
Yes, and a very funny. So one of the things that you'll find about me and get a sense of in my book is I love words, and I actually did a little bit of research on the etymology of sophisticated. And fundamentally, it used to mean perverted and corrupt.
Probably still does.
Right.
Like sophistry. Right, sophistry.
Yep, exactly. It's going out and gaining useless knowledge, and then you become perverted and corrupted to your own societal values and mores, rights and wrongs.
And what a wonderful fit for the wine establishment, huh?
Yeah, exactly. And when I'm in large groups and I say, the original meaning was perverted and corrupt, everybody feels more sophisticated immediately.
Well, now, what made you head off in this direction? You, after all, you're a master of wine. Many people would consider you yourself part of the wine establishment, and yet you rejected everything that means.
Well, not everything. There's some temper to this. But what happened for me is I started in my interest in wine and in cuisine in the mid-60s when I was very young, literally 14 years old. And that's what I've done my entire life. And I was fascinated by the history and the trivia. And so it kind of a unique juncture that I was able to start learning when a lot of the corruption of information was actually just taking a toehold. And so I found myself learning and studying. I was in the rare wine business. I became a chef by training.
You're professionally trained as a chef. I think that really is a very important credential was the kinds of things you talk about.
Yes, and also exactly, and that my training as a chef was very, very focused on the classics, which you don't see much anymore, Escoffier and Carême. My Bible was Larousse Gastronomique, the old version, not the modern version. So I came equipped with this wonderful sense of understanding the history and traditions, and then also being part of the spreading of the what we call fertilizer, which is another word for BS. And when I first sat the Master of Wine examination, I failed it miserably. That was 1989, and no American had ever passed it at this time. And I went to a seminar to learn about clear communications and writing, and I went to the wrong seminar, and it changed my life.
Let's go back to the beginning of the story that you include in this book, because you really do set out, turn the wine establishment on its head, carefully explaining why you think that's the right thing to do. To whet our listeners' appetite, start out by saying, I learned how to score a bottle of Chateau Lafite Rothschild before I could buy a six-pack.
Yeah, exactly. I grew up in Miami. My dad was the director of the Medical Association, and all the conventions and the so on, Miami Beach was the spot to do this. So very young in life, I was able to go to the Fontainebleau Hotel and go to French restaurants. I just immediately glommed onto it. And then I found in high school, if I could ask for a two-syllable French wine at a liquor store, nobody would ask for ID. So that was my entree.
So you were popular with your colleague, with your fellow young drinkers, too.
Yeah, exactly right. And back then, a bottle of a Grand Cru Burgundy was $3.50. And if I could say Corton, they'd say right over there.
but the funny thing is, you puzzled with this appreciation for the flavors of the wines that you tried. I think you struggled to come to terms with your knowledge of whether a wine was good or not. And you certainly found out that a whole lot of the rest of the population was incredibly confused, and in fact was drinking the wrong stuff.
Oh, yeah. What was very interesting is I had to learn what a bad wine was. I think that's what you're referring to.
Right.
Yeah, because everything was a new experience. I didn't know wine, really great Chateau-bottled red wine, should be this dark garnet color. I thought orange was fine until I learned that, no, it was a bad vintage, it was made wrong, and blah, blah, blah. So I actually had to learn what bad wine is. I mean, we all.
But then you finish up saying, almost, there's not nearly as much bad wine as people think. It's just that people don't appreciate wide variety that exists in wine, and they should.
Yes, and what that points to is something that's, the book is, it turns out to be much more about human nature in relationship to wine. So human beings love to judge and evaluate and rate everything around them. And so what the unfortunate thing that's happened over the past, say, 5-6 decades especially, is certain wines that have been historically welcome at the table, the consumers who consume them were not frowned upon, but, and especially sweet wines, they had a place at the table, at any table, in France, in Italy. They were celebrated, in effect, much more expensive, typically, than dry wine. But slowly, they became associated with beginners and unsophisticated and so on, and then false rationale was applied to why those are bad wine. What happened over time is less and less technically bad wine is made, and today there's really no reason to run into any technically bad wine. But that being said, the wine insiders, the sophisticates, us perverted and corrupted people, started to take entire styles or in types of wines and then classify those as bad. And
yeah, they dismissed them out of hand when,
yes,
in fact,
and then stigmatizing the people that like them. So,
right,
so
right.
That's the real trend.
So when did this new theory start to emerge? I mean, it seems to me that when you started the book, it didn't seem like you were going to finish up where you did.
Yeah. Well, the book started about 25 years ago.
Okay, so that's the answer, right?
And what happened was I was teaching about wine. I was becoming more and more noted as an authority on wine and on wine and food matching and on cuisine. And as that grew, I had a greater and greater cognitive dissonance that, like, something was really, really wrong. So the book was born out of this dissonance that started 25 years ago. And then at one point particular 25 years ago, I went to the wrong seminar, as I alluded to earlier, and it was actually about disruptive technology, and it was for electronic engineers, not wine people. and I stayed at the seminar for 3 days, and it just changed everything for me.
Right, so we should perhaps explain that the book we're talking about that Tim Honey has contributed is called Why You Like the Wines You Like, Changing the Way the world thinks about wine.
And your concept is vinotyping,
which is essentially getting to know yourself, and as a result of getting to know yourself and your vinotype, understanding what it is you're likely to like.
That's correct, yeah. And so to sort of qualify changing the way the world thinks about wine, we as experts are so focused on the product, we overlook the people. And that's not actually for anybody that I know who truly loves wine. It's really about the people and the community and the family and the table and sharing. But somehow, people have been totally left out of the equation.
And the people have different tastes has been left out of the equation too, right?
Well, anything about it. So the reason we call it actually vinotyping, like vino as in Italian wine, vinotyping is learning about what are our physiological differences that contribute to our sensory world, if you will, and to what intensity do we sense. And it's hugely different from one person to the next. And then also looking at the neurological factors of how the brain organizes information and creates metaphors, and that's changeable with education and life experiences and cultures and all those kind of things. So we actually quite literally take the word phenotype and turn it into venotype to help understand the concept.
And that concept says you should try to learn what venotype you are, because that will mean that your enjoyment of wine will increase.
Well, it doesn't mean your enjoyment of wine will necessarily increase, but it'll give you a better understanding and maybe more confidence for why you like what you like, and even more so for people in the wine industry to quit passing judgments so spontaneously just because they don't like something that nobody should like it because they're the reigning expert of the world or grand poobah. It's really, hey, how can I get to know you? The analogy I love to use, imagine you went into a shoe store and the shoe experts didn't know people have different size feet. So they put on a shoe that they know fits them and has a history and it was these designers, and you go, ow, that hurts. And they say, well, your foot's not mature. You'll learn to appreciate this shoe. You know, the experts have judged it really good. Something's wrong with you.
Now, give us your venotypes. You don't have very many of them, so just give us a quick introduction to each one of them so that people can start to get an idea of where this book will help them to figure out what they are and then what to do about it.
Let's preface this by saying this book should help you figure out your venotype, right?
Yeah, right. Well, I think so. There's a lot of clues in there anyway. So,
and also we've got a little website called myvenotype.com, myvinotype.com, and it'll take you through the series of typical questions we can ask about coffee preferences, how much you like or don't like salt, artificial sweeteners, and other markers that help to determine your what we call your sensory sensitivity quotient.
Right, but take us through just, if you like, the broad range of
the
white, the white Zinfandel lovers on the one hand, and the...
Well, let me take you through the... Before doing that, let me just take you through the four venotypes.
Sure.
Some things... Okay, great. So if you will, it's a continuum, and it goes from people with the most taste buds to the people with the least, which doesn't in any way construe more expert or less or a better taster or not or whatever. It's just physiological differences. So the first category is what we call the sweet venotype, and just simply, they're the people who want sweet wine, period. Now, what gets the wine industry all rankled about this is we can actually demonstrate these are the people with the most taste buds. And simply bitterness and astringency and sourness are experienced at such an intense level they can't stand dry wines.
Okay.
And it's about 70% women and about 30% men. Experts, and there are people across a whole spectrum.
Well, now, is it possible to be in that phenotype, but in terms of food, turn out to be a super taster? Because, I mean, I'm a super taster food-wise, but in wine, I like everything dry, and I don't like the sweet, but I have a lot of taste buds. We'll get to that.
And also the whole super taster paradigm, that's kind of another... I actually am good friends with and have worked with Dr. Linda Bartoshuk, who created that whole thing.
Uh-huh.
And it's an unfortunate choice of words. And so the next category, which is where you're probably going to fit, is what we call a hypersensitive phenotype.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
So you're highly, highly sensitive, and the specific compound probably called PROP, that is what the whole super taster paradigm, but the hypersensitive phenotype has very similar sensitivity or equal sensitivity to the sweet phenotype, however has a professed preference for dry wine. And that's usually then a neurological, that's a learned behavior. So the sweet and the hypersensitive phenotypes are both in this highly, highly bitter sensitive cacophony of sensations, and it usually also relates to visual acuity, hearing, touch sensitivity. That's probably where you are.
You know who also refers to this is Michael Pollan. I can't remember which book, but he talks about the same thing with the
The work that's being done on all of these concepts is profound. And my research colleague, who's very apparent in the book, and her contribution is actually a sweet phenotype, who's a pediatrician and sensory researcher at Cornell University. And so she studies the same sensory sensitivity phenomenon with children and development of behaviors and personality traits and all sorts of other cool stuff. And the next group is then the middle group called the sensitive phenotype. These are the most likely to be able to love relatively strong red wines, but they really, really want their wines to be smooth. They'll maybe equally like reds and white, depending on the mood and the occasion or even the, time of year. And so this is about 35% of people. So 25% and probably actually more of people are sweet phenotypes, about 25% hypersensitive, 35% what we call the sensitive, and then the other extreme is tolerant, which is only about 15% of people. The true tolerant taster is almost entirely men, and they tend to be also business leaders. They're very decisive. They're very goal-oriented kind of a people in terms of their behaviors and personality.
So once you've got yourself into the appropriate one of these buckets, what does the rest of the book tell you to do about it?
It actually then provides you with a way number one, some guidelines for what types of wines to explore, what to ask for when you're dining out or buying wines. It also then gives us some ideas of what experts should you turn to. So, yep, for example, a really great friend of mine, somebody I admire just hugely, is a wine writer named Dan Berger. And Dan is a champion for the hypersensitive phenotype. Hypersensitive phenotypes often find alcohol burns and is very unpleasant, and you can see this clearly in Dan's writing. He rejects high alcohol wines, doesn't know why they exist, feels they don't go with food and so on. And so if you are a hypersensitive phenotype and you're looking for recommendations, Dan's your man. Jancis Robinson, on the other hand, is right on that sensitive, hypersensitive, but she takes a very midline approach for big reds. She can tolerate more alcohol. She really, really loves smooth and delicacy, but she has a wider range of preferences. And then for the tolerant phenotype, you've got Robert Parker and Steve Hymoff and any of the 100-point system people, where more is better, bigger. And this is what's really fascinating is, at one end of the spectrum for sweet and hypersensitive phenotype, alcohol burns and is usually very, very unpleasant. But at the other spectrum, they actually sense it as sweet. So they love, the higher the alcohol, the more rich and the more wonderful and smooth the wine tastes for them.
I got one piece of advice out of the book that to me was the most useful and interesting. So I'm going to give you, and it's a view you expressed, by the way. I'm going to include that in this conversation, and then I'm going to ask you to agree or disagree or come up with what you think is your own best idea that people will get out of the book. The thing that I thought was the most interesting is you said, try pairings you don't like. and you'll be amazed.
Like what?
Because what happens is that's the basis for learning something new. So you hate that pairing, but you'll find out that you actually like at least a few out of 10 times. And that's really important because it's about how you grow. Now it's your turn.
Right. So the whole wine and food thing, and this is hard for some people to take, and it's a longer conversation, but I categorically reject wine and food pairing at every level.
Interesting.
So is that fairly clear?
Yeah, right. I mean, don't even think about it, right?
Let me tell you a little story, and this is very current. There's a really great restaurant in Napa, Fish Story, and it's part of the Lark Creek Inn with Brad Ogden.
Yeah, right.
And the director of it is a really great friend of mine, Michael Deller. And I approached him. I said, I need somebody to run a wine and food revolution promotion. And they said, well, why'd you pick us? I said, because you're clearly a fish restaurant in the heart of the iconic, intense, high alcohol, new French oak Cabernet Sauvignons that don't go with
it. Right, got it.
And they said, well, you know, we're really in a dilemma because we've added really great steaks and we feel we've got to compromise actually what we were trying to do with the whole restaurant. And then adding 100 white wines and whatever. But people come to our restaurant, they want to drink big Cabernets. And so, you know, so I said, okay, so last week we set up an internal tasting, and this is actually, we'll let you know when this comes out, but this is going to be a big promotion we're going to run this fall. I got with the chef, I gave them the book and the general manager, and they read the book. And then we did a tasting Monday of this week, and I had them put out clams and oysters and a bean snapper that's in an Asian noodle, ginger, you know, scallions kind of a thing. We had halibut, we had steak, had escabeche, and all these different dishes. And then we opened up a half a dozen wines, a Moscato, a Sauvignon Blanc, a Chardonnay, a Pinot, a Cabernet, and a big old vine Zinfandel. And I said, go. They said, go what? I said, try the absolute wrong wine with every dish. And the hypersensitive wine manager, Brenda, who loved Rieslings, loved the Riesling with the hanger steak, and she loved the Riesling with the oysters, and she loved the Riesling with everything. Well, of course.
Yeah.
And then the people who loved the big Cabernets, you should have seen the look on their face when they tried them with the clams and the shrimp. Because the shrimp Louis, that was the, you know, here's a salad, it's cold, with shrimp and the little remoulade sauce. It was just killer with the Cabernet for the people who love Cabernet. The tension of all this is try the wrong things because we rely so much on these supposed disasters, these looming food and wine disasters, that for the most part really don't even exist. We've made them all up in our head.
With a lot of things you made up in your head.
This is a longer conversation than we would ever be able to get into a program, I know.
But the fabulous part about it is you weren't frightened of anybody. And
the other part of this is what we call flavor balancing. And we've got great chefs from France and all around the world that are adopting this more and more at wineries. And that is, if you have sweetness and umami taste in your food, very typically the wine you like might become more bitter, even metallic tasting, and the more sensitive you are as a vino type, the more likely that is to happen.
So be careful.
So that's why foods like asparagus and sometimes certain fish with red wine and whatever create a very unpleasant experience, but only for a relatively few people. And if you put a little bit of salt and a little squeeze of lemon or lime juice, just like they provide you with in Tuscany or in Bordeaux or whatever, this is literally the foundation of classic cuisines, the wine goes right back into balance.
Well,
so there is actually a solution also if you're having an unpleasant you know, having your calamari with your Chardonnay or your Cabernet, and it's not a little squeeze of lemon, it'll take your breath away.
Well, we're still doing Pinot Noir with salmon tonight, and I'm not even going to discuss it with you anymore. It's time to say goodbye until you write some more wisdom and we can talk to you again.
Okay, fantastic. Thank you guys so much. It's really been a pleasure.
It's been so much fun. Thank you.
Okay, I hope we can do it again.
And we'll be right back after the break, not necessarily doing quite the same thing, but on the same general subject. So stay with us and we'll be right back.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Well, and here we are, and I'm really happy to get into this next interview because people so much associate Portugal with sweet wines.
Yep.
And the wine scene is so much more than that, and here we're going to be talking to somebody who...
Who's a real expert.
Who's an expert, indeed.
Devoted his life and his career to promotion of Portuguese wines, and they're a very different animal, as you'll find out as we talk with Miguel. Welcome to On the Menu, Miguel Nora of Wines of Portugal. And Miguel, your job at Wines of Portugal is to do what?
My job is to promote as much as possible the wines of Portugal, not only in Portugal, but abroad. That's our main goal at the Wines of Portugal board. And we've been, it's an association created 16 years ago that all the producers got together and created our association to help us boost the level of knowledge and awareness of Portuguese wines worldwide.
Now, were you prompted to do that because of the success that, say, Spain and Italy have had by making their wines better known?
Yes, well, I think it's a matter of first of Portugal, Portuguese wines. We've been producing wines for a long, long time, but mostly was for domestic consumption. And at some point in the early 90s, we decided that we needed to boost our exports. And for that, also we need, of course, to communicate better our stance of each one of our wines. We are a small country with several different regions, as for instance you said Spain is and Italy is. So we need to have a strong communication, but also focus in each individual aspect of each region, because from the north to the south, from the coast to the east of Portugal, we have very different wines and very different terroirs.
Now, so, we're going to talk some more about those in a little more detail later in the interview, but I'm wondering, it's really curious that you and I are talking, because you're Portuguese and I'm English, and in England we were always taught Portugal was England's oldest ally, and I think in Portugal they probably describe England as Portugal's oldest ally, and quite a lot of that, if you like, that closeness of the two countries was because of one thing, a wine product itself.
It's true. Well, many people know, of course, port wine, and that's how it was one of the main aspects of our friendship with England, because for many, many years we've been exporting ports to England, and also the main players in the port wine industry nowadays, many of them are British families, so still people that have been producing port wine for a lot of years, and now most of them not only producing port, but also discovered the potential of the Douro region in terms of table wines.
But it's interesting, isn't it? It's almost like port was so successful that in a way that made Portuguese wines seem really very one-dimensional and only suitable for certain kinds of uses, whereas in fact there was a whole range of grape varieties. But was it another thing that in fact even the names of the grapes and the fact that they were all heirloom to Portugal made them strange to the rest of the world?
Yes, well, you can look at on both sides as an advantage or a disadvantage. Of course, having a brand as port being so known and people loving it so much, then people tend to think, okay, Portugal is only about port. And to be honest, maybe 40 years ago, it was it in terms of exports. But especially since 86, when we joined the European Union, when we had a lot of changes going on in Portugal, not only in terms of winemaker, but also in terms of viticulture, in terms of marketing as well, wine marketing. The wine business really developed a lot, and in some countries now, table wines are even more known than some ports. So it's good to see that port is still on the top, but also some of our main regions and some of our main wines are getting there, and luckily also we've been awarded a lot of distinctions and a lot of high grades from the main critics. And so nowadays we like to think that port and table wines are both making Portugal famous.
We have been told in the past that there were some foreign winemakers, including one particularly well-known one who comes all the way from Australia, who themselves have made singularly important contributions to the improvement of wines in Portugal. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes, well, that particular winemaker is David Beverstock. Yes, he came from Australia. He fell in love for the country, but also for a lady that later became his wife. And he started working first in the Douro, so the region where he produced port as well, in the north of the country. And he moved to Alentejo, to one of the biggest companies in Portugal, called Esporão. And he's been producing wines for many years now. He's been there at Esporão, and his success is so huge that he's one of our stars in terms of winemaker. But he's not the only winemaker that came from another country and established in Portugal. We have several cases of people coming to Portugal, falling in love for a country that they didn't know, grapes that they didn't know, regions that they didn't know. And many of them describe it as being a challenge that it was so important for them that they decided to completely change their life and moving to Portugal and starting, in some cases, their own business, in other cases working for other companies, to discover and to share with the rest of the world our grapes and our wines.
Now, let's put a couple of dots on the map there, because you mentioned a couple of things geographically, and I want to make sure that listeners who don't know the map of Portugal are a little bit familiar. The Douro flows from east to west.
Yes.
So it flows for quite a lot of its distance through Spain, and there is an area on the Spanish side of the border, the river named slightly differently than
than
you know it in Spain, but it continues on through Portugal and then empties into the Atlantic Ocean near the city of Oporto.
Exactly.
So that's now the Alentejo region, which you just mentioned, is much further south.
Yes. So the Douro region is, in my opinion, is one of the most beautiful landscapes, and it's a region that flows around its river and about around its in terms of business around the wine business. It's very important, the wine business, for the development of that region. So that region that you mentioned, the Douro River, comes from Duero, from Spain. It's the same river but different name. And when it crosses the border from Spain to Portugal, it enters a region called the Douro, the same name of the river, and then goes up to, crosses the entire Portugal horizontally, and gets into the Atlantic Ocean close to Porto, where most of the port lodges are. This is in the north part of Portugal. Above Porto, you also have Vinho Verde region, which is a very important region as well in terms of wine, known mostly by its white wines. It's the region where it rains more in Portugal, and there are a lot of different climate and soil aspects that make them a very special region in terms of white wine producing in Portugal.
We sampled a wine from that region, Quintus No Magaca Torre de Vinho Verde. But there's something unusual about Vinho Verde, which I didn't realize before. It stands for green wine. And if I understand it correctly, the grapes are actually not altogether ripe when they're picked. Am I correct?
I didn't understand. Can you repeat that?
Well, the wine Vinho Verde means green wine, right?
Yes.
And if I'm understanding this correctly, the wine is called green because the grapes aren't entirely ripe when they're picked. They're actually green.
It's the reason of the green is also because it's an area where it rains a lot, so it's of course you have a lot of green aspects of nature. In fact, the harvest is normally a little bit earlier than the rest of the country, but and also the level of acidity is high. But it's a bit controversial to say that in terms of considering a fruit green. We call it vinho verde, so green wine, because it's more due to the landscape and the whole environment of that area.
Well, I was confused about that, so I'm glad you've cleared up that confusion. Now, yes. The other wine we tasted was from far south in the country, from the Alentejo DOC.
Yes.
And this is an area that's, is it north or south of Lisbon? I'm really not sure.
The Alentejo goes, it's inland, so east of Lisbon is in the coast, and then Alentejo is on the eastern of Lisbon, but it's a very big, it accounts for one third of Portugal.
Okay.
I know Portugal is not a very big country, but it's a big region in Portugal, the biggest region in Portugal. So it starts a little bit north, but the main part of Alentejo, south of Lisbon, southeast of Lisbon. So the wine that you tasted, it's a white wine, and it's normally the white wines there are, in this case, you have a wine that it has Rinto and Antão Vaz. So normally it tends to have one or two more grape varieties. The typical blend is three or four grape varieties, but Rinto and Antão Vaz are probably the two more known in Alentejo.
Okay, now let's. This is a region, Portugal, which is well known to holidaymakers who like to go to the beach, right? Going towards the south of this region is an area where a lot of Europeans who like to vacation on the beach
To go. Also, we're producing wine there, but still developing some projects there. But yes, then if you go, you are in Alentejo, when you go south, you will go to Algarve, where, yes, I'm sure we have a lot of, especially in the summer, many British and many Dutch and German, and from all across Europe and even from overseas, going to spend a few days of holidays, which is great there, and the climate is amazing.
No, a number of my relatives I know have been several times, but it's just a matter of Algarve was the word I was looking for. Algarve,
yes.
That was the one I was looking for. Now, we always believe, this is Anne and Peter, and perhaps, Miguel, you have the same prejudice. It wouldn't surprise me. We think a wine isn't really a wine unless it's red. Portuguese wines of real character that we have drunk have all been red. They've been red, or they've been composed of literally half a dozen, perhaps, different grapes, all heirloom to Portugal, all making what I would call a lusty wine, a big, bold wine. Am I right in describing it that way?
Yes, I think, well, like I said, Portugal has several regions, but if you have to sum it up in one sentence, I think you described it well. What we've been trying to do, and I believe is one of our biggest treasure, is to keep we've been producing wine for more than 2,000 years, and we want to keep our local grape varieties, because the grape varieties that we have come from experience that we have been doing since 2,000 years. So for sure, people have been testing each grape variety in each area, and we believe that the best grape varieties for each area are the ones that now are being worked. This doesn't mean that we don't work with also international grape varieties. From the Portuguese, what we call local grape varieties, we have 250 all across the country. So, as you said, as you mentioned before, it's for a foreigner, sometimes they are tougher names, people don't know the names, but I really, most of the people that I suggest for them to try to say the name and try the grape, that the wines that were produced from those grapes, people tend to be very... First, it's not that hard to pronounce. They see that, and then when they taste the wines, they just I'm glad you suggested this, because it's amazing wines made from these local grapes. But also in recent years, because of course some companies want to work better the international markets. Some companies, what they have been trying to do is pick up one Portuguese local grape variety and blend it with one international grape variety. You have that, for instance, in the whites. It's now fairly common to see Arinto, one of the most known white Portuguese grape varieties, blended with Chardonnay. Another example on the reds is to have Toriga Nacional, one of our also more known red grape varieties, with Cabernet. But you have other examples. So what we've been trying to do, because we are aware that it will take some time for the international consumer really get to know Portuguese wines, what we've been trying to do is make that job easier. And if you present a wine that is Arinto and Chardonnay, the consumer already knows how the Chardonnay tastes, and then they will have another acidity and freshness from the that is provided by the Arinto. And the same thing, they know already Cabernet, and they might be excited to taste Cabernet with a different grape variety, which is Toriga Nacional. So it's something that we saw that many companies are doing, and many of them have been a lot of success in international markets due to this approach.
So you think that trend's going to continue?
Yes, I think more and more. If you ask me what is the Portuguese blend, the Portuguese profile, I would say it's a blend of local grape varieties. But you know how these things are. It evolves, and whatever we think that can improve the quality of our wines, if adding, we already have a blend of three grape varieties, local grape varieties, if adding a fourth one, which is international, can actually increase the quality of the wine, for sure we will do it. We just don't want to abandon our grape varieties and just do as many others do, which is focus on five or six or seven international grape varieties. Because then you have a Cabernet from here, a Cabernet from there, a Cabernet. At some point, I'm sure you already heard about the ABC, anything but Chardonnay, anything but
Absolutely.
Cabernet, because people get tired. It's normal to after a few weeks, tasting the same wine, you want to try something different. That's why the wine business is so appealing and it's so amazing.
Now, is there a website that people interested in finding out more about Portuguese wines can go to get information about where to buy, where to go, what wines might taste like?
Yes, there is a website that was launched last year, which is winesofportugal.com. It's our international website where you can get information about our main grape varieties, our main regions, the pair to gastronomy, because for us, wine should be drank with food in most of the cases, and so we really are careful with the link to gastronomy from our wines. And you can also get information about producers. All the base information and generic information is there. And then you have inside that website micro websites. Actually, the US one was the first ones to be launched, and where you can find more about our activities in the market. Which events are we attending? Which promotions are we doing? Sweepstakes that we organize. So it's we try to also, in one case, to get the message through globally, but also to act locally, closer to the people. No matter if it's trade or consumer, we want to show and share the Portuguese wines.
Miguel, thank you so much for joining us today at On the Menu. We're delighted to have had this chance to explore a subject about which we didn't know near as much as we'd like to, and we're going to start learning more. So we're going to lean on you, I'm sure, to get more and more information over time. And our listeners will be able to go to the winesofportugal.com website and do the same thing on their own. And I can tell you from the four wines that we sampled recently and Portuguese wines that we have had the opportunity to drink in the past, this is a country whose wines are underappreciated and very interesting and make for some very intriguing wine and food pairings. So Miguel,
yes, I first of all just want to add that we've been seeing that throughout the world. Our exports are growing a lot. Only in the U.S. last year we grew 15%, and it's consistently, the year before 12%, so we're growing over the market average. And yes, I really appreciate the opportunity of sharing with you some more information about Portuguese wines, and let me know anytime you need any detail, any information about our wines, which are for us something that makes every Portuguese very proud of.
Well, thank you so much. I'm so glad you're proud of your job, proud of your country, and we wish you continued success. And as I say, once again, thank you so much for joining us today on The Menu. And we'll be back with an interview talking about wines that are new as opposed to wines that are old right after the break. So stay with us, please.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. We're darting over to California.
We are.
And I'm talking to a fairly recent winemaker with a very inspiring story. He's young.
Well, the whole project didn't start until 2009.
Right. And he was, 27?
He can still remember when he got out of high school. No, he's 27 now.
I think he's older than that now, isn't he?
Well, I'll listen to the interview and you'll figure it out. I listened to it again and again. So I know he said he's now 27. He's making a fascinating range of wines, from old world grapes.
And he loves what he's doing.
Yeah, but with a very new world and a very novel approach, that I'm sure will interest you. So let's hand it over to Colin with two L's, Cranor. Yes. Of Nottingham Cellars. They're growing grapes and making wine all over the place these days. Now, that won't be a surprise to you to know that our guest today comes from California, but it might be a surprise if we said, but he comes from the Livermore Valley in California, and the first reaction most of you are going to have is, where on earth is that? So fill us in, Colin from Nottingham Cellars.
Yeah, well, the Livermore Valley is located just of the San Francisco Bay, really still here in the Bay Area. If you were to travel on the 580 freeway, if you're familiar with the area, through Oakland, out due east, you'd drop down the Dublin grade, and you'd end up in what is the Livermore Valley. The heart of the Livermore Valley is obviously the city of Livermore, and we are very quality, it's a world-class grape-growing region that's really just starting to get the recognition we deserve. Although, you know, Livermore is just starting to come around and get the recognition, and this valley's been around since the 1880s.
Okay, so it goes back a good long time.
Actually, Wente is longest-running, continually operated, family-owned winery in California.
Oh, my, okay.
We've been making fine wines here for over 130 years, and we're continuing our innovations and getting better every year.
Now, if I called it the East Bay and said if you went just a little bit south from San Francisco and across that low bridge that runs all the way across southern San Francisco Bay and then kept on heading east, that's where you'd finish up.
Absolutely. The Livermore Valley actually encompasses far south as Sonol, and then in as far west as Castro Valley, and then up to Danville, and out as far east as the city of Livermore.
So, now, if you've ever been in that area, one of the more outstanding things that's out there is all the windmills.
Yes, yeah, blessed to have beautiful views of windmills as you travel east on the 580.
Now, these are not old windmills. These are the modern, shiny, aluminum ones that kill off all the birds.
Yeah, we've got some one-legged birds out here because of the windmills.
But it doesn't disturb the grapes, huh?
No, absolutely not. Really, actually, the growing region is separated from those windmills by some distance. So,
and I think we're going to be bringing you some more winemakers from the same region in due course. And there is, in fact, an association that you belong to, I think, Jeff, right?
Yeah,
Colin,
the Livermore Valley Growers Association.
Jeff's your dad. I messed that up. Jeff's your father.
They're basically an advocacy for not only wine producers but wine grape growers here in the Livermore Valley. They are charged with basically letting the outside world know that we're here. We have quality wines coming out of here at a lot of times a really great value in relation to the rest of the wine world. And we're continually growing, innovating, getting better valley, and we're really now just starting to find who we are and what we can do.
Now, you're in business with your dad, Jeff.
Yes.
And your last name, I won't try to pronounce it, so why don't you? It's Cranor, but I'm sure I'm going to get it wrong.
Yeah, Cranor. Colin Cranor.
Colin Craner, and your father, Jeff Craner, and he did something else before he got interested in wines.
Yeah, he was actually vice president or and a half owner of a manufacturing company here in the East Bay in San Leandro. They did injection plastic molding. So basically, you know, making parts for computers, pool vacuums was a big part of their business, and they had an automotive department that supplied NUMMI before it shut down, the old Toyota plant in Fremont here in the Bay Area.
Oh, right, yes.
Center consoles for Toyotas, matrix dashboard clusters, and that sort of thing.
Just the kind of thing to prepare you to make wine.
And you
told me before we came on there, you were working construction 4 days a week, so you decided you had 3 days to spare that you could figure out learning how to make wine.
Well, my dad retired in 2006, and his... the attorney that his business had worked with, who he'd become friends with over the years, they both shared a passion for fine wines. And Bill, my dad's partner, was interested in producing a little wine, but finding wines for a small, you know, exclusive wine club he had built. And that project was called Sater's Pond Winery. Typically sourcing bulk wines, they fermented a few different lots, but small lot stuff. Very, very good wines. And they hired a winemaker named Brad Morrison, who at the time was also starting to launch his label. So they were able to operate both out of the same facility, which, you know, was advantageous for any startup to be able to split some costs like that. Also, they got a winemaker to help them assemble these bulk wines and make sure they were bottle ready and that sort of thing. So they started in 2005 in Burlingame. I just graduated high school in 2004. I got right into the trades. I was a glazer. I did glass and aluminum systems on high-rise buildings. Again,
fits right in. Natural career progression towards winemaking.
Absolutely, yeah. My dad and I just have it in our blood.
Now your approach to winemaking is, let's make sure people understand, is that you buy grapes from people who grow them, and you select them because they have characteristics that you want, and then you proceed from the point of view, starting with the crushing of the grapes.
Yes. The business has evolved to a fully operational winery. We got to a point, and so the reason we are actually excited about Livermore is that during that project, Sater's Pond, Morrison Family era, in 2007, we started sourcing some Livermore wines at the time to put together an inexpensive California table red. And we'd use the Livermore wines basically as the base and the barrels that didn't make the cut from other programs, you know, to fill in the gaps. What we found after producing wines from the Del Arroyo Vineyard here in Livermore Valley after 2 years is that Cabernet, Merlot, Syrah, and Viognier, well, particularly the reds, were outperforming Cabernets and Merlots and Syrahs from much more established and renowned regions where fruit prices were much higher as well. Tremendous potential and value here in Livermore. Also, Livermore at the time was just starting to get on its feet, and we're calling the quality renaissance out here in Livermore was just starting to kind of take place, and thought it was a great time to get in on it. And so in 2009, my dad and I actually took the assets of Sanders Pond and moved everything out to Livermore, launched Nottingham Cellars, and the focus has been on Livermore Valley. We do source a couple from a couple of vineyards down in the Monterey County for some of our whites because of the cooler climate down there, just able to produce the style of wines we're looking to achieve a little better, but the bulk of our production comes from small vineyards here in the Livermore Valley.
How many types do you produce?
Well,
how many labels do you carry?
We have a pretty diverse portfolio. I'll give you a little insight as to my thought process here. I do a Bordeaux blend and a Rhone blend, which basically requires, by nature, that they are blends, that I source multiple varieties just to assemble those blends. See, we talked about that a little bit earlier. It's our Bordeaux-style red blend. We use all five of the Bordeaux varieties. So Cabernet Sauvignon, Cabernet Franc, Malbec, Merlot, Petit Verdot. And our GSM, exactly what I said it was, a Grenache, Syrah, Mourvèdre. So we're right there, two wines, eight varieties. What that actually allows me to do is source a little more than I need for those blends so that I could offer micro lots, you know, very small lot production wines. of single varieties, single vineyard varieties, the Bordeaux and Rhone nature. And I also do Viognier and Chardonnay for my whites.
For your whites, yeah. Now, we tasted six.
I thought you said for your wife.
Oh, well, no, girlfriend, she likes the Viognier.
She likes the Viognier.
I like the Viognier, too.
And like the Viognier, too. It's simple, but it's really good. The interesting thing is that the wines you shipped us were 2012. They're barely out of the grape skins.
Yeah, well, you know, the two whites I sent you were done in stainless. There's no barrel aging.
Right, right.
So those are wines that I can get in the bottle early and young, and right now I'm just starting to get those out. So Viognier and Chardonnay have been selling in our tasting room since, I think, the 1st of May. But they've been in the bottle since, I believe, January. No, yeah. I'm sorry. We bottled a little bit later this year. But we're able to get the whites out young. I also do a barrel-fermented Chardonnay that spends 12 months in barrel, and for that sort of thing, I'm going to hold back and do another 6 months to a year of bottle aging before we get those type of wines out. But the whites, you know, because of the nature and the types of wines they are, I want them fruit expressive and young,
sure, and
fun. So it works out for the program we're trying to achieve.
Now, you have a Petite Syrah, which is unusual. It's unusual to find that, at least in most of the wine world, it's unusual to find anything close to 100% Petite Syrah in a wine.
Yeah, Livermore Valley, a little history. Concannon, one of the bigger producers out here, arguably planted the first Petite Syrah in California and certainly bottled the first Petite Syrah as a variety. Actually, 2 years ago, we celebrated the 50th anniversary as Petite Syrah as a variety and 100 years of it being planted here in the Livermore Valley. Yeah. It's kind of our little culty insider wine, really, you know, Livermore Valley, the folks here locally they know about Petite Syrah. They love Petite Syrah. It's a big thing here. And I think I've found what I believe is, without question, the best growth site at Casa de Vinos for Petite Syrah here in the valley. And I'll go back on that and say that Livermore Valley, I think, is growing the best Petite Syrah in California. So I think I've found a really good growth site. And it's just consistent every year.
Well, I'm thinking of pairing that with tuna tonight instead of Pinot Noir, just to do something really racy and revolutionary.
There you go. It was 2011, so that was a cooler year. I would say of the petites that I've produced, I learned a lot in 2011 because of the cool growing season and late rains. We were basically put in a spot where we had to make a decision. Petite Syrah is a really thin-skinned variety and could be finicky in the vineyard, so we were put in a spot where it was, do we let it hang and potentially get some more ripeness and risk real rot and mildew and botrytis issues, or do we get the grapes right now and make the wine the way it is? And we chose to just lean towards the picking before any real issues occurred. And I got to tell you, in 2011, when the fruit came in, I wasn't excited about it. I thought it was underripe and didn't have the flavors that I typically have. But as the wine progressed, there were some things that I noticed that I really liked about the wine. And it actually kind of swayed my picking decisions in 2012. I started picking my Petite Syrah a little bit earlier than I typically do, just because I liked some of the leaner, more fruit-driven blue fruit and those types of flavors that were coming from the wine, as opposed to the heavy tannic beast, total black fruit, chewy, big, fat Petite Syrah that I'm used to making. So I do appreciate both, certainly, but I think the 2011 vintage actually helped me focus on creating a more balanced Petite Syrah, and that's something I'm going to take with me every vintage going forward.
That's great.
You really got into this, didn't you?
Yeah, I love it.
You really got into this.
Yeah, it's great. I mean, every year I get to, like I said, I used to work construction, so, which wasn't a bad deal. I really liked my job. But it was semi-repetitive, hard work, which I'm not happy. That's not a problem for me. I'm happy to work hard. But this is cool. I mean, it's just something completely different. I still am, I'm in my cellar right now, still looking around, thinking to myself, I'm making wine right now, and I'm on the phone talking about it with somebody.
Isn't that exciting? Huh? That's exciting.
I still sometimes don't believe it.
but the top of your line is a red Bordeaux-style blend called Supremacy.
Yes.
And we tried that one last night, and it just doesn't stop giving.
Yeah. Again, 2010, another cooler vintage. I loaded up the 10 with a decent amount of Petit Verdot to kind of fill in some of the gaps, and I love that. I love how the wine came out. It's again, a vintage where, you know, fruit's coming in and you're not that excited about it, and then as things progress, you know, the wines just turn out awesome. And, I think the coolest thing for me is my first year running a wine program was 2009, which in the Livermore Valley was, by everybody's standards, exceptional. And then my second 2 years were 2010 and 2011, where, man, it was gloomy around here. People were upset. They thought their business was done and the wines were terrible and all this. And you know what? It's not just me. People are coming around and the wines are excellent wines.
Well, you are a truly remarkable young man. I can't believe it. When we first started communicating, you're familiar with the term, of course, the little cartoon on the internet. Nobody knows you're a dog. Well, on the internet, nobody knows this young man who's telling you about all these wines he makes. He's only 25 years old.
Yeah, I'm 27 now.
27. You're getting to be an old man.
Yeah, I started young though, man. And I truly believe, you know what? I'm in a lucky spot. I mean, I wouldn't have this opportunity without, you know, my dad getting this thing started and me being curious. So I just I never thought it would be a career or anything like that. I just thought it was fun, and I somehow have convinced people that I'm halfway decent at it. So
there is no doubt about that. Now, if you want to find out more, listeners, you may not know. If you watch Robin Hood, you undoubtedly know how to spell Nottingham, but it's Nottingham Cellars, without any punctuation, .com, tells you more of the story and gives you the opportunity to find out where in their region you can buy the wines. But I'm sure that Colin would say the best thing to do is come on out and see us and take some home. I want you to promise, because we'll probably forget, that like 4 or 5 years from now, would you get in touch with us again and send us some more, and let's find out how much progress you've made in between times. I have a feeling that you're going to be a name to be reckoned with in the wine business, and I thank you so much for joining us today to tell the story so far.
Peter, I really appreciate it. Yeah, I'll just follow up by saying I'm absolutely happy and thrilled that I'll be back. I will be back in 5 years talking to you. Hopefully we can talk sooner. But locally, yeah, I mean, most of our wines are still here in California. Haven't made it over, you know, the state line. We do have some wines in Pennsylvania, in New Orleans, and in Washington, but pretty limited releases, I agree. The best thing is to come on out and see us. And if you are curious, we're also doing a web series where we're taking you through different processes in the winemaking process, or different things in the winemaking process. It's a web series called NCTV. That's also on our website, so I encourage you to check that out as well.
That's great. That's very good.
Yeah, and all of this is going on less than 30 minutes from San Francisco International Airport.
About 40 driving.
40 I used to drive pretty fast.
Yeah, 30, I can make it in 30, but I don't drive like that anymore.
I used to make it in 30. I used to run an office in Pleasanton, California.
Oh, I live in Pleasanton.
Yeah, is that Chinese restaurant still there on the main street that serves the giant California oysters?
Which one? What's it called?
I can't remember what it's called. It's 15 or 20 years ago, but I remember they had oysters the size of,
a baseball net.
Yeah, no, not quite, but pretty big.
Well, I got to check them out.
Thank you so much, Colin, for joining us today. Say hi to your dad, Jeff, and keep those grapes growing.
And, Peter, thank you so much.
Thanks, Colin. Bye-bye.
Right, talk to you soon.
And we'll be back next week with another interesting program in the annals of On the Menu Radio. And until then,
bye-bye.